All right. I hope that the university is going to give me a new tape recorder. I'm requesting it tomorrow. This is a continuation of the interview with Henry Lardy. It's February 28, 1984, and we're in his office. And let me see, it's turned on.
You're okay now?
Yes.
Well, we're going back to the fall of 1935 when I enrolled at South Dakota State University as a freshman. I needed employment to help finance my education, so I sought a job in the dairy department and was assigned the task of caring for experimental animals in experiments on vitamin D. We produced the first vitamin D deficient dairy cows, and the experiments demonstrated severe loss of calcium from their bodies, and they even lost teeth from their mouth into the manger as a result of the D deficiency. This work was conducted by Dr. Carol Wallace, who was an authority on vitamin D at that time. After 2 years of working for Dr. Wallace,
I do have a question there. How does that relate to the work that Steenbach did? I know that vitamin D had been discovered a lot earlier. What was new about creating vitamin D deficient animals?
Wallace's interest was simply to know how important vitamin D in the ration might be for dairy cattle. He wasn't pioneering any new concepts concerning the function of vitamin D, only to establish the need for it in mature livestock.
And how much they needed it.
Yes, and we did carry out supplements of at varying levels of vitamin D and established roughly what amounts of vitamin D the cow did require. We assayed the milk from these cattle and other feeds, for example, that went into the cattle with the standard Steenbach assay in rats, where you feed a D-deficient diet for a period of time, then you give a supplement for a fixed period, and then kill the rats and cross-section the bones and stain for newly deposited calcium in the epiphysis of the bone. Well, after 2 years in the dairy department, I obtained a position in the experiment station chemistry laboratory, which science students prized highly, because there one could carry out experiments under the supervision of Professor Moxon, and in fact many of the students published papers with Professor Moxon. Prior to Moxon's being head of that department, Kurt Walter Franke was head of the experiment station chemistry department, and he did many outstanding things in the area of experimental nutrition. He's the first man to develop the battery cage for handling large numbers of rats. He developed the conical feed cup that became a standard in the industry. He was very important in understanding the toxicity of grain from the selenium-rich soils of western South Dakota, and trained such outstanding people as Van Potter, who was a professor on this campus. When Franke died, Moxon took over and took over the direction of the laboratory, and many of his students were sent here to Wisconsin to obtain their PhD degree. When I was a junior, I think there were six or seven of us who came down to Madison to visit the biochemistry department, and every one of those students eventually came here for graduate study. In fact, one of them is going to receive an honorary degree in May of this year, Orville Bentley. As a senior thesis, I developed a means of removing toxic amounts of selenium from experimental animals. This consisted of feeding them bromobenzene, which conjugates with cysteine in the animal body, and it was suspected at that time that cysteine containing selenium instead of sulfur might be present in the tissues of animals that had been living on selenium-rich diets. And there was a dramatic improvement in the physical condition of dogs that had been poisoned with selenium on administration of the bromobenzene. Eventually, this was even used as therapy for humans who lived in selenium-rich areas and were suffering from selenium poisoning. We demonstrated, for example, that steers who were receiving seleniferous grains excreted very large amounts of selenium in their urine after the administration of bromobenzene to them. In June of 1939, I obtained a ride from Brookings to Madison, Wisconsin, with Dean Stallings, the librarian at South Dakota State University, and was dropped off at the front door of the biochemistry building about 5 o'clock one evening. Went in and introduced myself to Professor Paul Phillips, who had hired me, and he suggested that I arrive the next morning about 8 o'clock to begin work, and I didn't leave the lab, and neither did he, until midnight of that first day of work. This is typical of Paul Phillips's work day. He was at that time housed in a temporary lecture room because the space that he had ordinarily been assigned was disrupted by building of the so-called west wing of the biochemistry building. We used the lecture desk as our only laboratory bench that summer, and the problem I was to investigate was the storage of mammalian spermatozoa in order to develop methods for artificial insemination. Paul Phillips was had a farm background and believed that if artificial insemination were to be successful in the farming community, it would have to involve procedures that farmers could conduct with materials that they had available. So he suggested that I try all kinds of natural materials such as milk, butter, eggs, and so on as a nutrient for storing the spermatozoa. We very soon found that egg yolk diluted with a suitable buffer provided an ideal storage medium, and within a matter of a month or so, we were using stored semen for artificial insemination, and soon demonstrated that fertility was retained as well as motility for periods of a week to 10 days. Since I have already covered our work on mitochondrial function and intermediary metabolism and gluconeogenesis, I will today discuss only one other aspect of our research, namely that dealing with mammalian spermatozoa. After we established methods for keeping sperm for a week to 10 days, so that it could be used for artificial insemination, we were free to investigate various aspects of sperm metabolism, and while I was still a graduate student, we published several papers dealing with that subject. Some years later, when I was a professor in biochemistry, Gerhard Plaut, one of my students, did some additional work with sperm. And then there was a period during which we did not do very much with spermatozoa until Dave Garbers came as a graduate student. And at that time, we took up the subject more intensely.
What year is that?
I'll have to look up that year. So if you want to shut the machine off, I can tell you. Dave Garbers must have come to the laboratory about 1968. The first paper that he published with me was in 1971. and he had already published an earlier paper with Peter Reed from our laboratory. David discovered the enhancement of sperm motility by caffeine, which is of some importance experimentally because the effect of caffeine mimics that of an ovarian secretion, which results in extremely rapid motility of spermatozoa, and the so-called whiplash motility, which is much more vigorous than is expressed under ordinary conditions. This intense motility is believed to play a role in the penetration of the layers of cells that surround the egg and aids in penetration of the spermatozoa to the egg itself. David did a very nice study of the protein kinases in bull spermatozoa that are stimulated by cyclic AMP. This is in connection with the caffeine effect. And incidentally, he demonstrated earlier that the effect of caffeine can be mimicked by the simple addition of cyclic adenosine monophosphate or cyclic guanosine monophosphate to the spermatozoa. The next interesting episode in the metabolism of spermatozoa occurred when Susan Hudson and Neil van Dopp were graduate students. They undertook an intense study of pyruvate metabolism and demonstrated that pyruvate can be used under anaerobic conditions or in the presence of inhibitors that block ordinary metabolism because of the presence of a lactic dehydrogenase that's unique to spermatozoa and which is in the mitochondrial compartment of the sperm cell. This allows pyruvate to be oxidized in the absence of oxygen, and the electrons removed from the pyruvate are used to reduce other pyruvate molecules to lactic acid, and the resulting dismutation provides enough energy so that the motility can be maintained in the absence of oxidation processes. More recently, Donner Babcock came to our laboratory and having an interest in sperm metabolism, he chose to study several aspects of sperm function that have some practical consequences. For example, while studying the oxidative phosphorylation process in spermatozoa, Donner demonstrated that very little inorganic phosphate was taken up into spermatozoa, and that which was taken up appeared to be incorporated into nucleotides before it entered the inorganic phosphate pool. Probably it was taken up directly across the midpiece plasma membrane into the mitochondria where it was incorporated into ATP and then reached the inorganic phosphate pool only after the ATP was used for the support of motility. While investigating this phenomena, Donner began to investigate also the calcium movements and found that spermatozoa are extremely low in calcium, but epididymal sperm cells take up calcium rapidly from their surrounding medium, and in contrast, ejaculated sperm cells do not. This led to the demonstration that there is a substance in seminal fluid that blocks calcium uptake. The substance was isolated in pure form and demonstrated to be a protein with a molecular weight of about 10,000 and a slightly basic isoelectric point of about 8.6. the significance of calcium uptake by spermatozoa became apparent when Yanagamachi in Hawaii demonstrated the acrosome reaction could be produced in spermatozoa incubated in vitro, but only if they had calcium and peruvic acid in the suspending medium. We used our antibiotic A23187 to demonstrate that calcium could be taken up rapidly and would induce the acrosome reaction very rapidly in a high percentage of the sperm cells. And we now know that the process involves the uptake of calcium, the activation of phospholipase A2, the dissolution of the membrane on the acrosome, and the resulting liberation of hydrolytic enzymes such as hyaluronidase and acrosin from the interior of the acrosome. These hydrolytic enzymes facilitate the sperm penetration through the layers that surround the egg when it is ovulated. Oh yes, all of what I have described is in the reprints, in the published papers from the laboratory.
Did any of them come onto the faculty here, biochemistry? Or?
Some of my students have come onto the faculty. Julius Adler, for example, is one of our students, and Lawrence Anderson, who was one of my first graduate students, has spent his entire academic life at Wisconsin. I have other students who joined other departments. Bob Weaver joined pediatrics for a short period, and Mike McDonald, who was a postdoctorate fellow in our laboratory, is now on the pediatric staff. He does very good research and is also a very good diabetologist with infants.
So he's somebody who enables you to get some of your research done in the medical school.
Yes, we still collaborate and share mutual interests.
You mentioned as having some trouble getting research, getting space, didn't you, and support for his research?
Yes, I did. Another person who was a postdoctorate fellow with us for a few years is Earl Schrago, who is a professor of medicine and is still conducting very good research in areas closely related to what he did in our laboratory way back in the early 1960s.
Are these people that you, did you particularly recommend them to stay here? Or?
Well, I think they probably had sufficient initiative to make the approach to the medical school, but I certainly did recommend them when they were being considered.
Anybody in biochemistry? Is there in the biochemistry department from that's a student of yours?
Both Julius Adler and Lawrence Anderson are professors there. Yes.
So you must have gotten them into those spots as appointments.
I think that in both cases they were such outstanding students that their merit was made obvious to the staff while they were students, and when openings developed later, they were logical contenders for the position. Mm-hmm. Well, to round out the story about the sperm protein, we now feel that this protein is a decapacitating factor. It's known that sperm are not capable of fertilizing eggs at the time of mating, that they must spend some time in the female reproductive tract. We think that the sperm are prevented from developing the acrosome reaction at the time of mating, which is fortunate because it takes some time for the sperm to move up the female reproductive tract before they reach the eggs. If the acrosome reaction developed at the time of mating, all of these hydrolytic enzymes would have been washed away by the time they moved up the uterus and the fallopian tubes, and when they encountered the egg, there would be no hydrolytic enzymes left. We think the protein that we have isolated prevents calcium uptake. And probably it is digested away by hydrolytic enzymes, proteolytic enzymes, in the female reproductive tract. When the protein has been destroyed, calcium can be taken up, the acrosome reaction can occur, and the enzymes that are needed to penetrate the vestments of the egg very likely are liberated then at about the time that the sperm encounter the egg. We are in the process of purifying this protein in larger amounts to make antibodies to it, and we'll then use it to see if it's a universal regulator of calcium metabolism in other cells as well, or whether it is unique to the seminal vesicle, which is the source of this protein in the bovine.
Is this a way of finding an approach to birth control?
Yes, we have that very much in mind. We don't know how it can be applied directly, but it's entirely possible that if one knew about the appropriate inhibitors of proteolytic activity in the female reproductive tract, it might work very well to prevent the digestion of our protein and might thus prevent the acrosome reaction from occurring. The application, however, will have to come from the obstetrics medical people, since one is limited to what one can do with human materials these days.
Well, couldn't you try it out on animals?
Yes, it's our intention to do so with animals, but I think one is less concerned about controlling fertility in animals.
Yes.
Well, perhaps I should say something now about some of the really outstanding students that I've had. 55 students have completed their PhD degree in our laboratory, and I've had some 90 postdoctorate fellows and visiting professors during our period at the Enzyme Institute.
Okay.
So it's not possible to mention all of these people, and I consider them that almost every one of them was outstanding in some manner or other, but I will mention just a few. Those who were very influential in early periods in the Enzyme Institute were Gerhard Plaut, who was an assistant professor here and taught the enzyme laboratory course. This was true also of Stephen Kuby and Lafayette Noda, in turn. These were people who did outstanding work either as graduate students or as postdoctorate fellows. Both Kuby and Noda were excellent protein chemists and purified several enzymes in our laboratory. Gerhard Plaut had interest in a wide variety of metabolic studies. We had outstanding investigators from Formosa, or Taiwan, as it was called alternatively, depending on the political winds. We originally had the chairman of the biochemistry department, Ta Cheng Tung, and later Ko Huang Ling, and they sent in turn Yapin Li, who was an excellent investigator and who unfortunately died while he was at the University of North Dakota. Bunji Hagihara spent some time in our laboratory. He's a very distinguished Japanese investigator who in Japan developed a number of electronic instruments that earned him very good royalties. I've already mentioned Earl Schregel, Paul Ray, and David Foster were here at about the same time. Paul was a postdoctorate fellow from Professor Ed Doisy's laboratory in St. Louis, and David Foster was a graduate student from the University of Western Ontario in London, and those two collaborated on many of the interesting problems concerning the regulation of phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase by iron, by tryptophan, and quinolinic acid. I've already mentioned Julius Adler. During his graduate study, he discovered the role of acetyl-CoA as a stimulator of, or an allosteric activator of pyruvate carboxylase. We did not interpret his experiments correctly, however. We assumed that the acetyl-CoA was needed to pull the reaction in the direction of citrate synthesis, whereas actually it was stimulating because it was needed by the pyruvate carboxylase itself. This foreshadowed the work of Utter and Keach, published some years later, who apparently were unaware or may have been subliminally aware of the work that Julius had done. Will McClure did a very elegant study of pyruvate carboxylase from rat liver in our lab. He went to work in the laboratory of Max Eigen in Germany at Göttingen, returned to Harvard where he spent about 6 years and became an associate professor, and then moved on to the moved on to Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. About the time that Dave Foster left, we had, about the time Dave Foster was here, we also had two other Canadians, Jutta Kutis and Sheila Ferguson. These have both gone on to conduct excellent work on their own. Jutta has returned to Canada. Sheila Ferguson is at Michigan State University and has a very active research program. Among more recent graduate students, I should mention Giovanna Colombo, who published 4 or 5 papers from our laboratory as a graduate student and who has done sensational work at Pennsylvania State University as a postdoctorate fellow. Also outstanding was Margaret Merrifield, who worked with ferroactivator proteins and phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. She discovered the liberation of iron from mitochondria under the influence of cytosolic calcium, has been a postdoctorate fellow with Lester Reed since leaving here in 1981, and is currently seeking a permanent position elsewhere. There have been many colorful students and postdoctorate fellows. I haven't talked about the personalities of many of these people. This would be a story in itself, and probably we have always had individuals who seem to stand out as the social organizer of the laboratory whenever they were here. Maya Zila used to do this when she was a student. Bill Byrne was the social organizer when he was here. Social organizers plan the beer parties or the pizza luncheons, and they're rather costly as far as research productivity is concerned, because any pizza luncheon is associated with the consumption of at least one case of beer, with the result that the afternoon is probably spent chatting in the library rather than in the laboratory. But presumably some good ideas have arisen during these recreational luncheons.
Did you have a monthly quota of them?
No, it depends on birthdays or someone getting a PhD who probably was rather doubtful that he or she ever would. Some people take getting their degree in stride, others make quite an event of it, and it also depends on the opinion of the other people in the laboratory with respect to the desirability of celebrating for some individual. Some people deserve, or at least get, more attention than others do. I should mention also some of the outstanding people from overseas. We've had very early in our career Frank Lundquist came from Copenhagen, Bengt Borgström from Sweden.
How did they find their way to you?
Probably through interest in some of the papers that we had published. We've had people from Poland. I've already mentioned those from Japan and from Taiwan. Ken Tomita spent about 10 years in our laboratory before returning to a professorship in Japan. We've had Poles, French visitors, two or three from Switzerland.
I have a question about relations with other people on campus. Jim Crow spoke about the excitement that Joshua Lederberg generated when he was here, and how people came to campus to talk to him, and then other people talked to them, so that it was just a sort of fermenting bed of excitement. Is there anything like that here, or were you at all influenced by the presence of somebody like Lederberg, you and your students?
Yes, I considered myself a good friend of Josh. I greatly regretted his departure, because he had just achieved outstanding recognition, especially the Nobel Prize, when he decided to move on, and I felt that Wisconsin should have done something about retaining him, but I am sure that the administration did as much as they could. We frequently discussed the work that he was doing. I don't think he was so very interested in our work, because it probably was of negligible consequence as far as he was concerned. But it was interesting to speak with him about his concepts. The highlight of our contact with other people occurred in the late 1940s and perhaps throughout 1950, when enzymology was really the top interest area in biochemistry. During the latter part of the 50s and in the 1960s, the nucleic acid science exploded, and as a result of the 1951 discoveries of Watson and Crick, and enzymology took a back seat to the new areas that were being developed. But in the early 1950s especially, we had a large number of visiting enzymologists who came for Wednesday night seminars, and there was always a great opportunity to visit with them here in the Enzyme Institute. Many of these people are the giants of biochemistry, such as Corey and Ochoa and Kornberg and so on. It's interesting that some of those outstanding enzymologists also became major contributors in what you might call molecular biology in later years, such as Kornberg and Ochoa. Some, such as Corey, for example, remained in the metabolic regulation area that they had made their original contributions. But we still continue to have very good relations with other people on the campus. We have interacted with people in the medical school, with investigators who are interested in practical problems that deal with enzymology, for example, metabolic diseases and inherited metabolic defects.
What about anybody in zoology, for instance, Hans Rietz, he worked in chromosomes, would that have any?
No, this is rather far removed from our area of interest. We're certainly aware of his important contributions, but our research interests don't actually overlap.
So nobody in botany or zoology or chemistry on the LNS campus?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. We were very interested in some of the things that Bill Johnson and... Bill Johnson and Alfred Wilds. We also were fairly close to Van Tamelen and have maintained some correspondence with him since he moved to Stanford, where Bill Johnson was chairman for most of his career. We've interacted with people in the entomology department, in dairy science, animal science, but I think probably most of our interactions have been with people in the medical school who have some interest in enzymology as it applies to their problems. We've continued a collaboration with Neil First for many, many years and have shared students and postdoctorate fellows. He does an outstanding job in the area of animal reproduction.
Well, was Kurana a kind of person that generated excitement around him?
Yes, he certainly was. We had relatively little contact with one another because of his research area being far different from ours, but he was a pleasant person to visit with socially. I was very much taken by some of his ideas concerning his place in the world, so to speak. On one occasion, I believe it was a Thanksgiving day, we met on the street on Thorstrand Road, where we both lived, and had probably our longest conversation. He informed me that he had retained every letter that he had ever written or that he had ever received, that he recorded a summary of every conversation he had ever had with fellow scientists, and that someday he would be writing his biography. He cited Bertrand Russell as being able to do that when he was in his high 90s, and Gobin allowed as how he would also do the same.
Oh, fascinating. Did you ask him when he was here last summer whether he was still doing it?
I think he's far too active in the laboratory to be considering starting to write, but I'm sure he's still gathering the papers.
It didn't inspire you to do the same.
I should say not. I don't think that the average scientist's contribution will be remembered for very long. science moves very rapidly, and most of what we do is rather ephemeral. I am intrigued by Jim Doyle's statement that immortality consists of being remembered by three friends for 6 months after you die.
You know, I went down to the basement of the library to find something about enzymology and found some books that were, one was written in 1903, I think, and one finally, its sixth edition was 1925. And dimly, as I know the subject, which is nearly not at all, I could realize how very primitive, at what a very primitive level they were. But I saw that what they had to do, what they did for you to have reached what you've reached. So there is that, I mean, none of it is wasted, is it?
That's right. It's all the information that one gathers bit by bit provides a base on which somebody else does something important. But then you must recognize that there are some times when you move to a new and higher plane. There have always been some outstanding individuals who have contributed far beyond the average contribution of the period. For example, J.B.S. Haldane, who I think was trained as a geneticist and perhaps as a mathematician, became really one of the first theoretical enzymologists and wrote a beautiful book that is still a good source of information. There are many, many things that we could talk about with respect to the role that a good library and a good university plays in the development of scientists. I used to spend a great deal of time in the Ag Library when I was a graduate student and in early years as a professor, and it's very interesting to think back on some of the events. For example, I remember one of the most intriguing books I ever read was by Ivor Bang. I think the book is entitled Der Blutzucker, Blood Sugar. And I learned there about a fascinating story concerning the discovery of blood sugar as an important body constituent and the controversies that raged around the question of whether sugar was a normal constituent of blood or not. And the giant Claude Bernard was one of those who was opposed to the idea that blood sugar was a normal constituent. He thought it was present only in the portal circulation, where the sugars were absorbed from the intestine and taken to the liver. And a large controversy raged in the French literature, and a commission had to be appointed to settle this controversy. And it was decided that Claude Bernard was correct, that there is no sugar in normal blood. Well, later he turned out to be the giant of carbohydrate metabolism as far as its distribution in liver and blood and so on is concerned. But he certainly started out with erroneous ideas and must have held back progress in this field for some years because of his prominent position as a French authority on such subjects.
This is late 19th century, is it?
I don't remember exactly what period it was. We once had an authority in our history of science department on Claude Bernard, and at a cocktail party I once asked him whether Bang was correct about these terrible stories about Claude Bernard, and he said, oh, he certainly was. He was interested in knowing that a biochemist knew anything about this period of Claude Bernard's science.
Yes, well, how did that come about? You said the importance of libraries to scientific research, and then this was when you were a graduate student that you discovered this?
It was either while a graduate student or an early part of my professor career. I think the important point that I wanted to make is that someone had the foresight to put good books into the library of the College of Agriculture. And such books as Ivor Bang and J.B.S. Haldane and Sir Arthur Harden were very important in developing my concepts in biochemistry. One of the episodes that I'd like to tell you about is deals with René Dubos. I knew he was an outstanding writer, and when he published Louis Pasteur, Freelance of Science, I bought it at the first opportunity, and I can remember sitting on my porch one summer Sunday afternoon reading this book and telling my wife that, my God, I had read this somewhere before. I was sure I had read this book, and yet it was just off the press, so it couldn't have been read elsewhere. It finally bothered me so badly that I went to the Ag Library and started searching through books that I thought might deal with the same subject, and in Sir Arthur Harden I found everything, word for word, had been transposed from Harden's Alcoholic Fermentation into Louis Pasteur, Freelance of Science. This bothered me a great deal. I was an idealist in those days, and so I dreamt up the idea that maybe when Pasteur was a student or a graduate student, he had written a term paper and copied liberally from Sir Arthur Harden, and then in later years had found this term paper and had read so beautifully, he thought, gee, maybe I can write a book on this guy. Well, I wrote to Dubos and told him about the sections that had been copied from Sir Arthur Harden, and wondered if this had been an accident from one of his earlier writings or just what had happened. And I received a scurrilous letter from him. He said that if I were as knowledgeable in the field of epidemiology and history and language and several other areas as I was in biochemistry, I would have found many similar examples. That he had discussed the question of whether he should use footnotes with his publishers, and they had ruled that this would be inappropriate in a book of this type. So he felt free to copy without altering even punctuation in some cases. He did point out that he had included all these books that he was quoting in his bibliography, and of course I don't think that's an adequate acknowledgement of the sources.
I don't believe it. I mean, I don't believe a publisher would permit that.
I don't either, no. And I discussed this point with Josh Lederberg, because it was this happened when he was still in Madison, and he suggested that it wasn't worth pursuing.
Oh, really?
Yes, he didn't think I should write to Dubos asking him about this.
Well, why not?
I don't know.
I mean, did he not believe you, or did he think there was nothing that could be done about it? And
no, he certainly believed me, but I think he thought it was of no particular significance, since this wasn't a scientific research paper that was involved, but a novel, so to speak, or a biography.
But I'm still intrigued with your going to the library. These weren't required readings, presumably.
No, certainly not. That's just browsing. And I hope students still have time to browse in the library.
No, they don't.
The Ag Library is really very good, not only in areas of science, but it has a fantastic collection of really old, marvelous books on dogs. And I walked in some 3 or 4 years ago and found a very intriguing jacket hanging on the place where they exhibit the jackets of new books dealing with Arabian horses. And since we had a half Arabian horse at the farm that I was very fond of, I got this book, read it, and we're now in the Arabian horse business at our farm.
It's a library too.
It is, but in science one can find so many intriguing things by moving into areas that are not directly in your line of work. And I think that's one reason why students should be encouraged to use libraries. The Ag Library always used to be a very interesting place, because the chief librarian, whether it was Heen or whether it was the man who followed him, was always willing to go with any student and help him find any kind of information. When the library was in Ag Hall, it was very crowded, and much of the materials were stored away in various places. But all one had to do was to ask Mr. Heen about a certain subject, and he would lead you to the appropriate box where the materials were that you needed.
I just find it amazing that you have that you were doing this when you were a graduate student, because you did describe your schedule, which was 7 to 12, and...
We didn't work 7 to 12 every day of the week by any means. And I think most students who are strongly motivated probably abandon all other forms of entertainment and just stick with their research interest when they are graduate students. I know that I don't think I went to the movies very often, and I think that I was in the lab almost every evening until I got married, and then spent some time at home, but I was still in the lab many evenings after, well, as a graduate student, as a postdoctorate fellow, and in the early parts of my teaching career in the department.
Have you ever asked any of your students here whether they go over to the library and browse?
Well, yes, I have, and I sometimes encourage them to do so by posting interesting items concerning new books and so on. We probably discourage such browsing by the fact that we have a very good library right here in the Enzyme Institute. I pride myself on having bought a lot of good books for our own use, and well, for example, four of them came in yesterday. Not only do our students use our library, but the students and postdoctorate fellows from all the other groups in the Enzyme Institute use our library, because we do have a good collection of journals and of books.
Yeah, but they're just on enzymes, I suppose.
Well, that and related areas of biochemistry.
You don't have Bang's book.
No, we don't. We do have a few old treasures, however.
So you're cutting down on the possibility of the students expanding their knowledge by having a good library here.
Well, if they become interested in our library, perhaps they might search further, and then the medical library and the ag library are available to them. I think it's fortunate on this campus that we do have branch libraries, such as the medical library, the ag library. There's a good one in engineering, good one in zoology. I think this encourages students to use what's readily available.
Did any of your colleagues or your fellow graduate students indulge in this sort of thing? Do you remember?
I can't remember specifically. I think that one is encouraged to go to library sources by taking courses as a graduate student, which compel you to dig into the literature for the materials you're going to cover in a review paper or in preparation for exams and so on. This is in contrast to many European countries where no academic courses are required for graduate study. They ready to go?
Yeah.
We see, for example, that many of the postdoctorate fellows who come here from abroad have a much narrower outlook than the students that are trained on this campus, for example.
Well, I suppose I could repeat the story of Connie Elmy talking about the biochemists at Cambridge who could write poetry in Latin for their yearly publication. Do you have anything like that here? Do you ever get a newsletter out? I mean, one that's amusing and...
No, The nearest thing to that was the Yellow Cardinal, which used to be published in the bacteriology department on the Ag campus. That was quite an important document in the late 1930s, early 1940s. No one knew who published it, but it scandalized a good many people.
What was its nature?
It was simply a mimeographed newsletter, so to speak, that came out, I think, once a year or maybe twice a year, and was full of some good humor and some rather vicious humor, and most of it at the expense of the professors and at the expense of some of the students who weren't regular fellows, shall we say. And it was always a mystery as to where it was published or where it was printed and who was connected with it. Oh, yes, in later years it became known that certain individuals, such as Wayne Umbright, for example,
was
one of the writers. He was an interesting person who left here and went on to Cornell. He was here while I was a graduate student and during the early years of being in the biochemistry department as an assistant and associate professor. And I guess one could go on and list many, many people like that who were important in forming your own ideas concerning research and science.
You started off with the statement of how the university and the libraries help scientists. Can you give another example? I mean, here you turn up with this wonderful story about your experience in the Ag Library. Can you think of anything else to?
Well, there were many occasions as a graduate student when one would be faced with a problem and then would go to the library and come up with apparent answers that were in the journals that led you then to do a more meaningful experiment. Another factor that was important in developing the students during my era was a fantastic symposium held in 1941 on respiratory enzymes, I believe the subject was. Such distinguished investigators as Corey, Harlan Wood, Fritz Lippmann, Otto Meyerhoff, Hermann Kalkar, all came and presented talks. It was the first symposium that I had ever seen or even heard of. We were rather confined, I should say, in biochemistry during the period of my graduate study because of World War II. I came here in 1939, and the war began in the fall of 1939. I didn't know anything about scientific meetings until some years later. I don't even know whether the American Society of Biological Chemists met during those war years. Probably they did, but my professor wasn't informing us about these meetings. At any rate, the symposium was a tremendous influence on the students in the department, and of course nowadays we see to it that our students go to meetings, deliver papers, and attend symposia when they are in the area of their interests. Communication is much more extensive and at the present time than it was then.
Of course, in a very small way, that reminds me of a question I had earlier. You're so far away out here in the Enzyme Institute, and I know you say that you go to the biochemistry building, but your students presumably don't have much occasion to leave the building. I mean, do they take courses over there?
Oh, yes. Our students are biochemistry students, so they take all the same courses, and they do their teaching stint in the biochemistry department. We do have less contact on a day-to-day basis with the people in biochemistry than they do with each other. There are some disadvantages and perhaps some advantages. We can think more than a person who's interrupted constantly by a flow of traffic of all kinds over in the biochemistry department.
What about your research into crib death, or not your research into it, but that simply was an offshoot of what you were working on?
We became interested in this disease when Senator Mondale was holding hearings in Washington on the disease. He felt that it had been neglected by the medical research community, and for the first time in my life, I became aware that there was such a disease. We listened to the testimony, and it occurred to me that maybe these infants were dying of hypoglycemia. And the reason...
It's explained in the article that what the scientific explanation of it, I mean, what your theory was. So go ahead and say... Excuse me.
Well, apparently I have covered the scientific basis of our search in this area. We obtained livers from the Milwaukee Children's Hospital and a few from local hospitals, and then we negotiated with a doctor at the coroner's office in Cleveland, Ohio. They have a city law that compels every child that dies of an unknown cause to undergo a post-mortem examination by the coroner's pathologist. And they find a relatively high incidence of crib death in that area, presumably because of the poverty, in, especially in the black community. And we obtained some 60 to 80 liver specimens from them. Our data show quite striking differences between the normal infants who have died of some accident and the crib death victims, or the sudden infant death syndrome victims, with respect to the enzyme phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. We've not been able to convince the medical community that this is a cause of death. We don't know whether it is a cause of death or whether it is simply something that is associated with whatever is killing the babies. The problem is an intriguing one because it's a very serious disease. It's the most important killer of babies from 1 week to 1 year of age, and it's second only to accidents as a cause of death between 1 week and 15 years of age. We don't know how to pursue the problem with respect to alleviating diminishing the incidence of the disease. My only thought is that if I were raising infants, I would see to it that they went to bed with porridge of some kind that might be a source of carbohydrate through the night.
But pretty simple, isn't it?
Well,
it's a simple way of preventing something.
Like, well, it would alleviate the carbohydrate shortage for at least part of the evening interval when they are not getting milk. It's obviously not a universal cause of, or not a universal phenomenon. Where were we?
Well, you've talked to doctors presumably here in the medical school about this.
Yes, there doesn't seem to be much interest within our own medical school. I've talked to physicians elsewhere, and they don't seem to be oriented with respect to an interest in carbohydrate metabolism as a possible problem in sudden infant death syndrome. Clinicians, for example, feel that blood sugar is not abnormal unless it's lower than 30 milligrams per cent. And for premature babies, they say it's not abnormal unless it's less than 20 milligrams per cent. And these are concentrations that can lead to permanent brain damage, in my opinion. The problem of convincing physicians about a biochemical subject is a rather difficult one, and we don't wish to impose our ideas on them, but we would certainly love to see them use our findings as the basis of some investigations into the disease, and that hasn't been done up to the present time.
Did you say one of your students was in pediatrics?
Yes, Michael McDonald, his area is diabetes, and he's has more than his hands full with the diabetic population. As a result of him being such a good physician, his stable, shall we say, of diabetic patients has increased tremendously, and he's very fully occupied with that work and hasn't given any thought to sudden infant death syndrome.
But he couldn't shake somebody else by the shoulder and say, "Do something about this."
I don't know. I'm unfamiliar with the relationships and the interaction between various people in the pediatrics department, so I don't know if he's ever tried to interest anyone.
And couldn't you test it on animals?
There's no animal model for sudden infant death syndrome. It is rumored that the veterinary school at Washington State University in Pullman has a family of cats that undergo what might be something like sudden infant death syndrome. Some of the kittens are found dead when they're about half grown without showing any previous symptoms. And I have offered to assay livers from these animals and have offered to teach them how to assay for phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase, but to the best of my knowledge, they've never looked into the subject there.
Well, what do they say when you offer to do it?
They expressed an interest. We made this proposal to them at a meeting of the National Institutes of Child Health in Washington, or Bethesda, and they expressed some interest, and I encouraged them to write or to send me samples, and we would do the assays and send them the data, but nothing ever happened.
Of course, if you went and published a talk to a reporter and had this published in a newspaper, wouldn't you get quite a stir?
Anything dealing with sudden infant death syndrome gets a big stir in the newspapers, but unfortunately that's where most of the ideas concerning the disease have been published. Every 6 months or so, the cause of death or the cure appears. It may be botulinum toxin in honey or biotin deficiency or cow's milk. Every conceivable cause of death has been proposed at one time or another as the cause of death of this disease, but no one has ever been able to pinpoint anything and documented it and established that it really is associated with the death of these infants.
But you still think that perhaps this is an explanation? I mean, you haven't given it up.
No, we think that there is a relationship. This is the only biochemical defect that's ever been found, and we have a speculation as to what may be involved. For example, we have found that some of the infants that died of sudden infant death syndrome had reasonable amounts of glycogen in their livers, even though they had a very low phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase. It's conceivable that the infants who die of this disease have a defective hormone system so that they are not producing enough glucagon or enough catecholamines. Perhaps that would account for the fact that the enzyme is low and they still have some glycogen, because maybe they're unable to mobilize that glycogen. We know that both catecholamines and glucagon are inducers of phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase, and if you deprive an animal of his glucagon, then the enzyme decreases in amount. We don't have any way that this can be studied in infants. One can't get liver samples from 1,000 infants and hope to find 3 that might be defective in their ability to mobilize the hormone. So We can't investigate it, and we don't have an animal model to investigate it. There are many experiments done in animals which would indicate that that is a possibility. For example, one can administer endotoxins to puppies, and their blood sugar drops, and their phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase drops, and they die. And one can prevent their death, and in fact prevent most of the toxicity of the endotoxin, simply by giving the little puppies glucose, intravenously or orally. And that certainly tells us something about the factors that regulate the respiratory system, because it is the respiratory system that seems to fail first when blood sugar drops very low, and it is assumed that the respiratory muscles are the site of failure in sudden infant death syndrome, at least by some people.
Well, I hate to miss any more stories you may have about Corona or that you come out with, but there is the period that you were on the university committee and chairman of it, and you've not said a word about that. I don't know whether you want to talk about any of the issues, but I'd be most interested in what you'd have to say about some of the people that were on the committee at the same time, or your dealings with Harrington. Who impressed you as being outstanding in whatever you're required to do in the committee? And
well, I think our period was one of relative calm on the campus. We didn't have a lot of crises. We were, I think, probably the biggest controversy that we dealt with during my chairmanship was the question of whether or not physical education should be a required course and whether the students should get credit for it. Did I talk about that before?
No, you didn't, but that's all in the minutes. What isn't is the people. That is, you also had the medical school business that was going on,
I admired. Well, let's go back to the issue that I was telling you about, the physical education requirement. I had called each of the deans of the various schools, and they all said that if credit were given, they would raise their requirements for graduation by one credit. So the university committee was opposed to granting credit for the physical education. The faculty, however, outvoted us, but the regents supported the position of the university committee, and they did not grant graduation credit for physical education. Concerning the people who are on the committee, all of them were marvelous men like Ed Young, who still is with us here teaching. I don't know what happened to Boischer. I haven't seen him in years and years.
I think he died.
He may have. Jim Crow, of course, still very active and outstanding. We dealt with Elvium during my chairmanship. He was the president of the university at that time, and certainly dealt with Harrington, who was the vice president, and I had a very warm feeling for both of them. When the Harrington regent battle took place, and it was rumored that the regents were meeting for the purpose of discharging Harrington and replacing him, I sent a message to the regents meeting, and many years later Fred told me that this was the only letter of support that was sent to the regents when they were considering discharging him. Our relationship with Harrington, I think, was somewhat closer than it might have been, because his vice president was Robert Clodius, who we had known for many, many years, and we were close friends of him. So I was sympathetic to many of the things that he was doing. I don't think my tenure on the university committee overlapped with Harrington's administration, however.
Mm-hmm. You did write him a note. Thank you. just, you wrote him a note thanking him for accepting the presidency, but I think that must have just been at the end of your period. I made a mistake last time. It did happen under Elvian that the money began going into the social sciences from Worf. It was at Harrington's push that it was happening, so but you were right. Mm-hmm. It was during under Elvian. Mm-hmm. Did Elvian come to meetings much, or did you have many dealings with him as president?
I don't think he ever attended a meeting of the university committee. I don't think the president usually does, but he was certainly always available because of our earlier relationships in biochemistry.
There was the Hamish candid camera of people, of blacks applying for apartments too. Do you remember that? And whether they should, the film should be shown?
No, I don't remember that at all. Apparently, I put a lot of things out of my mind. I do know that one of the first big controversies in Madison concerning housing was Lafayette Noda, who was a postdoctoral fellow with us, had taken a black student as a tenant in his apartment, which he in turn had rented from the Welsh family, and this became quite a controversial issue. I don't remember anymore how it was settled, but we eventually became very good friends of that man, who was Ted Johnson, the husband of Diane Johnson, who worked in our laboratory for about 10 years and who is now one of the assistant directors of the athletic department. And also we knew the Welches very well from meeting them skiing. I think that Madison has come a long way in the matter of integrated housing. Some of our other friends were involved in that as well. Bob Brooks, for example, was the first person to integrate apartment houses in Madison. And I think that was a beneficial thing for the community.
Who was he?
Bob Brooks was a real estate agent who had a large number of apartments, and he saw to it that integration was possible. And also, he was engaged in a number of very touchy situations with respect to selling homes to black people, and stuck by his guns and managed to integrate some of the new development communities, the one that was south of the Beltline, for example. I've forgotten what the name of the community was, but there are some very interesting stories in the manner in which they went about integrating their community. You asked about the role of our extracurricular activities and recreation and so on. For many years, I had almost no hobbies of any kind and worked weekends as well as many evenings. And this must have been hard on my family, but they'd never complained. It was hard on me because I developed ulcers and had two bouts of bleeding ulcers. Since taking up hunting and farming and horses, the ulcers haven't bothered at all. I'm sure my research output isn't as great as it might have been had I avoided some of these extra activities, but they've been very enjoyable.
I mean, so there really isn't a link between, because when we talked with Van Potter, that he made a very strong link between your ulcers and David Green's presence.
I don't think that David precipitated my ulcers. The first serious episode I had was in the fall of 1950, just about a week after I moved into the Enzyme Institute, but my move to the Enzyme Institute had nothing to do with the ulcers, I'm sure of that.
I see, so they're therapeutic, your horses and dogs.
Surely.
Yeah. What sort of a person is Beinert?
Beinert is a very talented person and an interesting person to converse with about areas outside of science as well as science. He got his start in the theater, and in the early 1930s he realized that there was no future for actors in the Hitler's Germany, so he decided to be to go back to school and become a scientist, and he did, and became a very successful scientist. He was a graduate student during the war. As a result of his theatrical training, he is a marvelous speaker. He's entertaining, he speaks very effectively, and some of the most impressive talks I've ever heard on casual occasions, such as the retirement of a secretary or something of that nature, have come from Helmut. He's gifted. And of course he's recognized as the father of the application of electron paramagnetic resonance to biological science. He was the first to apply this technique to enzyme systems and has been the doyen of that area ever since.
Yeah, you did say something about that. I'm going to, at your suggestion, be interviewing Frederick Mohs, whom you recommended for one of these.
Yes.
Tell me your impressions of him and what kind of a person he is.
I first became acquainted with him as a result of hearing Van Potter talk about his chemosurgery technique. And consequently, whenever there was a lecture on the campus by Mohs, I was attending. And I don't recall whether this was while I was a graduate student or an assistant professor, but on one occasion he brought a patient in and showed us a young lad that had been very badly sunburned and from whom he had removed some 100 or more cancers from his body surface, and told us some of the very sensational cases that he had treated successfully. For example, a case of a brain tumor where the skull was kept open for a very long period of time while he applied his chemosurgery technique to the tumor area on the brain. And when the cancer cells were all removed, he administered either glucose concentrated or urea, I don't remember which, to cause the brain to shrink, and they put the lid back on, and the boy survived the operation, and there was no occurrence of the cancer at the time he told us about it, which was many years after it had happened. He developed this technique while he was a graduate student in the zoology department, and then felt that he would have to be a surgeon in order to apply it, and he then went to medical school after getting a PhD. And I think he's been one of the most highly underrated people in the world. I've read magazine articles about chemosurgery, for example, that have described the marvels of this technique, and there wasn't a mention of Mohs, who was really the father of this technique.
You're pretty sure of that, are you? That he was?
Yes, I'm quite certain of that.
I was surprised. I noticed he, for instance, he hasn't been appointed to the, well, I guess he wouldn't be, to the National Academy of Sciences.
No, they do not have any surgeons, as far as I know, except for someone like Huggins, who at Chicago, who has a Nobel Prize and who is a surgeon, but his techniques or his prize involved techniques that were biochemical in nature. That is, they dealt with the role of hormones in carcinogenesis and in treating cancers.
And that isn't true of what of Mohs' work.
It's not very biochemical in nature. No, it's a surgical technique, and I guess you wouldn't call it. I don't know if you'd even call it medicine, if you distinguish medicine from surgery. There is now a National Institute of Medicine where physicians are enrolled, but it may be that surgeons are even outside of that organization.
His folder is very thin. His news and publication folder, I was quite surprised.
He's trained a good many people in this technique, and that, I think, is commendable. Perhaps his trainees are the ones who will be carrying it to the rest of the world.
Just at the end of the tape.
Perhaps...
All right.
I was going to say that perhaps as we wind up this session, I should say something about the interview. Sometimes one can sit down to write a manuscript and the words just flow beautifully and your ideas are well organized and so on. And at other times you can sit down and face that paper and nothing seems to come out very well. And I think that I'm in this second category today with I wasn't very inspired in speaking about what has gone on in the past. There are probably many stories that would have been more interesting than what I did tell you, but I can't recall them at the moment.
Well, maybe what we can do is you would jot down some of them as you think of them, and when you accumulate some, call me back.
Well, perhaps we've recorded enough for posterity.
What follows is the conclusion of the discussion on 6/28/83 of the McCarthy period.
When
Progressive
the,
publicity.
An issue devoted solely to McCarthy. I took a large bale of these magazines to the Federation meetings in Atlantic City and sold them on the street. And they went so rapidly that I phoned back to have another batch shipped and sold those as well. And we were very active in many areas. We tried to raise funds to support Tom Fairchild as McCarthy's opponent. However, McCarthy was reelected, and eventually Tom Fairchild went on to be a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It was 2 years later that Joe Must Go was organized by the man who started Wisconsin Trails at Sauk City. And then the famous hearings in Washington at which the military was being interrogated by Joe, and Joe was being interrogated. And eventually this led to his downfall, of course, but it was quite apparent to anyone who wanted to think about it, that he was a demagogue right from the beginning, and was a shallow person.
Were any of the other of the five faculty members?
Yes, there was Malcolm Gordon from the Department of Physiological Chemistry. I don't think there was anyone else from biochemistry that I can recall. I don't know if Van Potter was a member of Citizens versus McCarthy.
No,
he wasn't, no. We had a few local physicians, mm-hmm. and a few businessmen.
So it wasn't no other faculty people at the very of the.
Yes,
first.
Willard Hurst
oh,
from
I
the law
I was
school
wondering if he might have
was
been
a member.
Uh-huh.
I recall that.
Connie Elvium said that Connie Elvium had bawled you out on the train station because you had a sticker on your suitcase and he thought you shouldn't bring politics into scientific meetings.
That
but
must
you
have
don't
been on the way
that.
To the Federation meetings. I don't recall it, but I don't imagine he was very angry about it. I know that at that time there was a great deal of pressure on the university to institute a loyalty oath, and Fred resisted that. And I was told by Carl Link that the American Legion had brought a list of known communists to Fred, asking him to discharge them, and both Link and I were on that list. Mm. I wouldn't know a communist from a Republican.
Actually, apparently the story is that he called up Middleton and said, "What would you do if I asked you to sign the loyalty oath?" And Middleton said, "I resign."
Yes, I heard that. Yeah.
What my question was, it was, have you gone on being interested in, conscious of or active in national events or policies? Or,
oh, yes,
has
certainly.
It, has it in any way affected what you've done in your research?
Well, I don't think so. We have participated in fundraising for candidates. At one time I was secretary, or treasurer, pardon me, I guess, of one of Gaylord Nelson's fundraising efforts many years ago when he ran for the Senate. We've always supported good candidates.
Yeah. I was thinking of things like the concerns about pollution and population and that sort of thing, whether you would...
Half of my annual contribution to the university's charity drive goes to Planned Parenthood. We're very conscious of the importance of population control. And our research in sperm is always aimed in some manner or other at the possibilities of developing better control of fertilization.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
We're very much concerned about pollution. We have two farms at which we exclude herbicides and insecticides whenever possible.
Okay. I realize an important question that from my point of view is whether you were aware of the struggle of the social sciences to get funding from WARF, and whether you were sympathetic with it. You know, the money had been going into the...
This was, I believe it was Connie Elvium who lifted the ban against support.
No, it wasn't, but...
Wasn't
I mean,
it during his administration as president that money from WARF became available?
Well, to some extent, it didn't really break open until later. But I'm curious about your own feelings about it, whether you were aware of it or concerned about it.
I was aware of it. I know that a few years ago I was aware also that history gets more money from the graduate school, money that originates with WARF, than any other department on the campus. And I know that there are many people in biochemistry who feel that the majority of the money should go to those areas in which the royalties were earned.
Do you?
But no, I don't believe in that. I think that it's not possible to raise funds in through scholarly work in most departments of the university. So I think that if there are patents that are lucrative and the funds are brought into the university administration should decide where the funds are needed. In fact, many years ago, when I was, I think it was before I moved to the Enzyme Institute, I wrote a letter to the then dean of the graduate school, I don't remember who it was, suggesting that no WARF money be made available to people in biochemistry, because adequate funds were available from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, and that the WARF money should be available to those departments that were not supported by the NIH. And there are many departments that met those criteria. That is, there just weren't categories in Washington to support their research.
Were you thinking of places like chemistry, physics, or geology, or were you thinking of social sciences?
Social sciences. Chemistry and physics are eligible for funds from NASA and the National Science Foundation.
When did you say this? You said it was when you were an assistant professor?
Well, perhaps associate professor. I think it was during...
So it would have been Elvium.
While I was still in the biochemistry department.
Elvium or Baldwin, it would have been.
Yes.
Well, I suppose that's very interesting. Good for you. You must have known of Van Potter's Committee on the Future of Man.
Yes.
Interdisciplinary. Were you interested in it? Or?
Interested, yes. Not to the same extent that he was, but I wasn't asked to participate and didn't participate. I think endeavors like that are important. One must be careful, however, if you're a natural scientist and move into an area like that, there's a possibility of being more naive than you really realize, and not necessarily contributing a great deal to the field. for example, I can't, Wilson at Harvard has opened a new area called sociobiology, and we're very interested in this possibility, but it looks as though he is being pretty well taken apart by people who are more knowledge in these areas than he is. And I think that it's all right to explore these possibilities, but to declare them as new areas of endeavor and to indicate that you have some new insight that previous scientists haven't is pretty dangerous.
Is there anything you can think of that we've missed?
Well, there are thousands of things we've missed, but I don't think they're important enough to record.
All right. Well, thank you. I hope that the university is going to give me a new tape recorder. I'm requesting it tomorrow. This is a continuation of the interview with Henry Lardy. It's February 28th.